This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on November 20th, 2008. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Morning, we'll now begin the open session of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, November 20th, 2008. Mr. Vice Chair, I understand we have correction approval of minutes, agenda document number 8-41.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd move approval of agenda document 0841, which are the minutes for the November 7, 2008 open session.
All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed. Passes 5-0.
Yeah, I apologize. It is November 13th, 2008. Thank you very much.
But we did adopt the correct agenda document. Right, so the document will speak for itself, so we don't have to redo that. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. For...
Just 1 minute.
Right.
Yeah, thank you very
good.
Much.
Very good. Before we begin, I'd like to take a few minutes to announce the results of the Commission's audit. This is only the fifth year the FEC has been subject to an audit of its annual financial statements. Given the size of the agency, years ago, the Congress had not mandated an audit, but that changed. We're extremely proud and pleased to convey once again achieved an unqualified clean audit opinion, and I want to thank some folks for this. I think this is an exceptional performance that reflects the hard work and dedication of the entire FEC staff and our Inspector General's office. It's a significant accomplishment for the FEC and one that could not be achieved without the devotion, talents, and extraordinary efforts of our CFO staff, particular Judy Burning, Brian Duffy, Ken Pizzella, and especially Aaron Sing Sing Shook. Their perseverance in sustaining high performance for the FEC's financial management continues to strengthen internal controls throughout the Commission and raise expectations for years to come. I'd also like to thank first the Vice Chair. He is our man on point, as you would think, for the all things financial. We have various committees here, and he runs the Finance Committee, and he certainly put in the hours to ensure that this went through. I'd also like to take a moment to single out Erin and personally thank her. Erin has been most valuable to the Commission's success of achieving a clean audit opinion for the past 2 years. It's the period she was here as CFO. The Commission saw a marked improvement in financial management upon her arrival nearly 2 years ago, as highlighted by the results of the audits. She worked endlessly in preparing the Performance and Accountability Report, commonly known as the PAR in the trade, to ensure it was of the highest quality, and her dedication to the Commission has proven invaluable. And on behalf of the Commission, thank you very much, Erin. Erin is leaving the Commission and going off to do other things. So thank you for your help, and thanks to all the staff for cooperating and helping, and be remiss without recognizing the Acting Staff Director, Mr. Stoltz. He was actually very diligent and helpful as well. So thanks to all. Appreciate everyone's indulgence for my public service announcement. Moving to the actual agenda. First up, draft advisory opinion 2008-16, the Libertarian Party of Colorado.
Mr. Chairman, I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda document 0840, the draft advisory opinion for the Libertarian Party of Colorado.
Without objection, so ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, Commissioners. Before you is agenda document number 0840, which is a response to a request for an advisory opinion from the Libertarian Party of Colorado. The request seeks recognition of the requester as a state committee of a political party under the Commission's regulations. The draft concludes that based on the evidence provided, the requester does qualify as a state committee of a political party for the following reasons. First, the Commission recognized in a 1975 advisory opinion that the Libertarian Party, the national organization with which the requester claims affiliation, qualifies as a national political party under the Commission's regulations. Second, according to a letter submitted by the acting executive director of the Libertarian Party, the requester is part of the official Libertarian Party structure. Finally, the requester is responsible for the day-to-day operation of the Libertarian Party at the state level, as demonstrated by its placement of federal candidates on the ballot in 2008 and 2004, and by the day-to-day functions and operations as set out in the requester's constitution and bylaws. We received no comments on the draft, and I would be happy to address any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Any comments or discussion? Parties ask for these, they tend to be the standard response that if you want to be subject to our jurisdiction, welcome to the club. I've told that joke before, but the open meeting audience changes, so to some of you that's new. It's not new to anyone up here. Well, there you go. So do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve agenda document number 0840 and the recommendation made therein by the Office of General Counsel.
Okay, all in favor of the draft advisory opinion of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? That passes 5-0. I want to note for the record that Commissioner Hunter is not here. She had pre-existing obligations that actually existed before she'd even joined the commission, and I had consulted with her to see if it was okay to still go forward with the open meeting, and she was fine with that given what's on the agenda today. But I want to note that for the record that she not here, but that was planned and anticipated, and we're doing this with her consent, or at least acquiescence. Next item, report of the audit. Thank you very much. Report of the audit division of the Missouri Democratic State Committee.
Morning.
Morning.
It is my pleasure to present the report of the Audit Division on the Missouri Democratic State Committee. The audit covered the period of the 2004 election cycle and resulted in two findings. Finding number one is cash disbursements. The committee made 408 cash disbursements totaling $62,522. Each of which exceed the $100 limitation. Finding number two is the payment of federal activity with non-federal funds. It should be noted that the report had been circulated, then withdrawn, and recirculated with changes. The amount to be transferred from the committee to the non-federal account appearing on pages 4, 6, and 11 will need to be changed from $2,541,689 to $1,931,979. And I will answer questions.
Thank you. I objected to the proposed final audit report, not because of finding one. I think it's unfortunate they made some disbursements over the rather small thresholds. It's there's some past MERS on point that for other state parties that made the same mistake, and I think that's a rather clear situation. I also didn't object because they, on that ground, because it seems like this party's had some issues before. They've had at least one enforcement matter that's public, which they agreed to pay a civil penalty. They've also instituted a number of new internal controls and seem to be attempting to get cleaned up, so to say. But where I did object was finding two. The allegation that they pay for federal activity with non-federal funds. And I see the numbers have shifted some.
Yes.
As I understand it, you have three, there's three issues. First is the salaries and wages. The rule at the time was that if an employee of a state party spent more than 25% of their time on federal elections-related activity, they would have to be paid for with all federally permissible funds, so-called hard money. If that were not the case, they could be paid for with 100% non-federal funds. It's not the rule today.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
It's one of the many Shays, it's like the Rocky films, one, two, and then Shays in 3D. But it was really, I think, probably Shays 1, Shays 2, and Shays 3. Said that you had to pay for that on a ratio. So the rule in 2004 was it's either going to be all hard or all soft on the salaries. Second, they made quite a bit of disbursements, which they say were for television, radio ads, phone banks, lodging at National Party Convention, which I think that some of this they have established, to your satisfaction, was 100% non-federal. But there's still some of that where the recommendation is that it wasn't non-federal. It was actually either federal or allocable, I think. Or
right.
Was it, right.
Well, quite a few of the disbursements, we did not have any documentation at all. We didn't even know who the payee was. So we had checks being dispersed as well as wire transfers being made of pretty large amounts of money, and we could not tell what it was for or to whom the payment was being made.
Okay. And the third sort of funds are the admin expenses. Whether or not it should be allocated in the overhead ratio or whether it could be 100% non-fed. Let me ask you about the documentation, because that seems to be the issue. And it seems to me, so you know where I am, is that you have a state party that says that this money was spent for non-federal activity, and their explanation is that it was done on ads and other activity that was designed to assist their gubernatorial candidate. Right, there was a gubernatorial election going on. A lot of the spending was in actually the off year and early. It was not really near a federal election per se. And the ads apparently expressly referenced their gubernatorial candidate. And I don't see anything in the record that showed that any of this material actually referenced a federal candidate specifically. So you have a state party that says that, which is would be, if true, I would think, a non-federal expense, and then they get audited, and then the position is, well, they really couldn't prove through sufficient documentation that it was 100% non-federal, so therefore seems like we're then going to infer that it's federal unless otherwise proven. Is that
is correct.
Okay, what's the legal basis for that inference?
I don't know that there's a legal basis for that, but that's been a matter of audit policy for quite a while. When
okay.
we go out to do audits, we look at the non-federal expenditures and attempt to discern the nature of the expense, and if it appears possibly federal, then we pursue it.
Okay, I understand. Where I get hung up on the documentation, if it truly is non-federal, is that something that would be within our jurisdiction? Ask a hypothetical. A state party runs an ad that expressly advocates the election of the gubernatorial nominee. Is that within our jurisdiction?
Go ahead. Well, in that situation, it wouldn't be, because that doesn't, it's not a federal election. But getting back to the issue, we're in the regulation. Section 104.414 states that each political committee shall maintain records which shall provide in sufficient detail the necessary information and data from which the filed reports and statements may be verified, explained, or clarified. Now, regarding the allocation of non-federal election activities, the regulations also state that the committee treasurer must retain all documents supporting the committee's allocation of expenditures and disbursements. So, really, the disclosure reports aren't self-verifying in audit context, burden of production would necessarily rest with the committee.
That's certainly true for allocable expenses, right? But if it's not an allocable expense, it kind of begs the question to say, because they don't have documents to that relate to it being an allocable expense, it therefore must be allocable or all hard. If it truly is 100% non-fed, why wouldn't that be beyond the reach of that reg?
But you don't know at the outset whether the expenditure is 100% non-federal without the documentation. And 10414 applies not only to allocable but also non-allocable expenses. And that
100%, does it apply to 100% non-federal non-allocable expenses?
Well,
I agree it applies to non-allocable.
It's an issue of documentation because you don't know whether it's 100% allocable or not, or if it's 100% federal or not, without knowing, without having the documentation.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, what the regulation says is that you've got to keep the records that are necessary in order to demonstrate the accuracy and the completeness of your reports. If it wasn't 100% non-federal, but you spent 100% non-federal funds on it and didn't put that on your report would be incomplete. And this is some of a discussion, akin to a discussion we had last week. The question then becomes, what do you do if the committee says, well, we're going to assert to you that this was non-federal, but we don't have the records to document that. I don't think it's any big surprise that when the auditors go in and audit a committee that engages in both federal and non-federal activity, that they're going to, one of the big things they're going to be looking for, they're going to look at the non-federal accounts expenses to confirm that the expenses from that account really were for 100% non-federal activity or were to pay the non-federal share of allocable activity.
Even though our regs don't reach that far, nor does our perhaps our jurisdiction?
Well, I'm not sure that I would necessarily agree that the regs don't reach that far. The regulations say that you have to keep records sufficient to demonstrate the accuracy and completeness of your reports. And so one of the ways that you're going to have to demonstrate the completeness of your report is to show that you didn't omit from that report something that shouldn't have been paid for with non-federal funds but was. I guess it's a question, what do you mean by does our jurisdiction extend? Our jurisdiction, the Act doesn't prohibit the spending of 100% non-federal funds on 100% non-federal activity. So the question is, was the activity 100% non-federal activity, and how do you demonstrate that? And the question then really becomes, if the committee says, well, it was 100% non-federal activity, but we don't really have any way to demonstrate that.
Well, let's explore that for a minute. Let's actually talk, because it seems to me that this is an assumption or an inference. Do we agree that this is an inference?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What we do know factually, I think, is what they filed. I presume they filed reports with the state of Missouri.
That's correct.
Is that correct? Did they file these particular expenditures with the state of Missouri, characterizing them as state expenditures?
Yes.
Okay. Now, is that consistent with drawing an inference that spending would be allocable or 100% federal?
We would tend not to want to rely solely on disclosure reports as documenting the nature of an expenditure. We would much rather assure ourselves through seeing some other type of documentation.
I understand. To answer my question, though, does that mean that is inconsistent with the finding of the audit?
Let me see if I understand the question correctly. Are you asking if by reporting these as on their non-federal reports, is that inconsistent with the audit report?
Right.
Right. It's inconsistent as far as our determination of the nature of the expenses. As I said before, we would much rather rely on something other than a disclosure report to assure ourselves that it is in fact 100% non-federal.
Okay.
So that is opposed to what we're saying in the report, at least with respect to some expenditures. Originally it started with about $5 million in expenditures, and they provided documentation for about half of that.
Okay.
To resolve it.
Picking up on the answer to my question, I think I heard you say that that you don't want to base it. The report, the non-federal report, essentially isn't enough to prove. Let's go back to the first premise. Then what's the finding based upon, other than, is it based upon anything other than the inference that because they didn't provide sufficient documentation, that therefore it must be something other than 100% non-federal?
No, I think most of the finding is based on the fact that in the absence of documentation, we're questioning the nature of it.
Okay.
So we
agree again. The same question I asked Mr. Calvert, at least he was the one who answered the question. We're dealing in sort of an inference here, right?
That's correct.
Okay, all right. And that's why I asked now, the fact they reported this stuff as 100% non-federal, is that consistent or inconsistent with the recommendation? It would be inconsistent with the recommendation, right, which would, I think, knock back this inference somewhat. At least in my view, it does.
Say that again.
Okay. You're relying on an inference.
Correct.
Okay. They have filed a report with their state, presumably under oath.
I don't know if it's under oath. But
okay. Well, let's say they filed a report.
Okay.
And that report says it's 100% non-federal. Okay. That report is inconsistent with your report. Right? They can't both be true.
That's correct.
Okay. So the report that they filed is inconsistent with your recommendation.
With respect to the expenditures we're questioning, yes.
Right, okay. So wouldn't that then undermine the ability to draw the inference that's being drawn here? If one looks at the, I'm not saying that to a matter of law, it stops it, but it certainly undermines the idea of drawing an inference.
If I might, we can back up a step from there, from the report they filed too. The fact that they paid it from the non-federal account, I think, is an assertion that it was a non-federal expense, as is the report. Don't think anybody argues that. Experience has certainly not shown that this is always a reliable assertion, because we have findings all the time with party committees and others who have federal and non-federal accounts about things being paid out of the wrong account. And of course, it goes both ways. What the commission has done heretofore is to say, all right, we are going to take a position. You have to be able to show which account this should have been paid out of, federal, non-federal. And that the fact you paid it out of the non-federal account and presumably filed a state report consistent with that doesn't provide sufficient evidence that that was in fact the case. Otherwise, the reports are essentially self-proving. The non-federal reports are self-proving.
I understand that, but we're living in the world of an inference here. And when you live in the world of an inference, I would think that we could then go through what we do know that's fact and not the inference and see if those facts are consistent or inconsistent with the inference. And that's all I'm trying to do. I understand that the report in and of itself is not conclusive proof that it's non-fed, but I think it's certainly probative. After all, the party, and I think they cite in their papers that they are in part relying on the report. That is something that I think would be admissible evidence. I think it would be some sort of business record and exceptions to the hearsay rules. I think they could admit it for the truth. Now, whether the finder of fact agrees or not, that's an issue for the finder of fact. But as a matter of law, it's certainly relevant, certainly admissible evidence, and it would certainly undercut the inference. And that's what I'm trying to explore here is whether this inference holds up. So we have the report, which was filed. We'll call it semi-contemporaneously when the money was actually spent. I've read the materials that the party has provided, and their main theme is that these were activities that were designed and referenced their gubernatorial candidate. Now, why? Again, that theory of the case, that I think is inconsistent with a finding that it's something other than 100% non-fed. So what's our thought on why the state party's theory that these were money spent to help their gubernatorial candidate, why does that fall short?
Well, the documentation that we have, or actually the lack of documentation, doesn't allow us to associate those expenditures with gubernatorial type expenses such as media.
Okay. Let me take a moment to talk about the lack of documentation on some of this. Okay. I have in front of me here, this is the submission of the Missouri Democratic Party to the interim audit report. Okay. Seems like there's a lot of documentation here, and I've actually read the documentation. There is an affidavit from consultants, and they're saying that it was non-federal. They have charts that describe the spending in ways that to me seem wholly consistent with what they're saying, and undermine the idea that we can infer. Now, some of this I think is factored in the report as revised, because that's why the numbers were shifted. But I'm drilling down here to show that if all we have is an inference, when there's facts that contradict the inference, I'm not so sure the commission can then rely upon the inference to declare that a state party, which Congress has drawn a line and says that there's a difference between what the federal law reaches and what only state law reaches, and when you do it solely gubernatorial candidates, that's a state law question, that they can't then spend 100% non-fed. But then we're going to say, because you didn't keep documents, or you couldn't provide us records that we think you would need, even though otherwise you wouldn't be subject to our reach, that we're going to infer that it's a problem. I would suggest it's not just an inference, it's a presumption, because when you're talking about the fact they didn't produce documents or that kind of thing, they haven't essentially rebutted an unwritten presumption. And when we presume things, that's really not consistent with either kind of rule of law or how we kind of do the administrative world, where we need to let people know. If we're going to go down this road, I would suggest we need to make clear that unless you can produce documents, we're going to assume. And I also that's my concern, is that I've read the file, I've read what they've submitted, and it seems to me that they make a rather strong case to rebut the inference that seems to be the sole basis to find that what they did was 100% non-fed. So that's where I am. Now, we haven't really dug into specifics here and whether or not the employees really did spend more than 25% of their time. I see there's some affidavits here from, I think, supervisors or whatnot that say, no, they were doing gubernatorial kind of activity. And I also note this was the 04 cycle, correct?
Yes.
Right. It's the first cycle under McCain-Feingold. So it's not surprising that maybe this probably isn't the only state party that may have stumbled into what's federal election activity and what isn't federal election activity and what sort of documentation one would need to keep to prove all of this. But it just seems to me that if we're going to rely on an inference, the Democratic State Committee here in Missouri ought to be able to rebut that inference And I think they certainly have rebutted the inference. Whether they rebutted the what seems to be the implicit and unspoken presumption, I leave to others. In my mind, I think they probably have. Does anyone else have any thoughts or comments? Mr. Weintraub.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not quite in the same place that you are, because we're talking to auditors. Their job is to go out and look for the underlying documentation, not just to take the reports at face value, but to look for the underlying documentation. So if we are going to take the reports at face value and say we don't really care if there's underlying documentation, then we should stop wasting our money sending auditors out. And I'm sure that the folks who get audited would be really happy to not be audited and not to have to go through all that. But that's the nature of what they do. And it's, you know, we have an established program of auditing, and it doesn't surprise me in the slightest that when our auditors go out there, they're looking for records and they're looking for underlying documentation of everything. And we started to talk about some of these issues last week, and because I agree with you that for entities that do both state and federal work, where most of our requirements really establish record keeping requirements for their federal activities, you know, what do we do when something like this comes along where they don't have documentation, at least, you know, let's say the perfect kind of documentation that would make our auditors happy, for all of their non-federal activities? And I think that the regulations are, you know, perhaps as is often the case, not a model of clarity, but the regs that were in effect, looking at the salary issue, the regs that were in effect at that time said, at 106.7, committees must keep a monthly log of the percentage of time each employee spends in connection with a federal election, allocations of salaries and wages shall be undertaken as follows. Salaries and wages paid for employees who spend 25% or less of their compensated time in a given month on federal election activities or on activities in connection with a federal election shall be paid from funds that comply with state law. But it seems to me that if they have to keep records, and including records for salaries and wages paid for employees who spend 25% or less, then it's not completely out of our jurisdiction for our auditors to be out there looking for the time logs for the non-federal activities. Well, that's the perfect world. You know, in the perfect world, our auditors would go out and they've had wonderful time logs for every single activity that every employee did. And obviously they didn't find that. But I also said last week I'd accept affidavits. You know, sorry that Commissioner Hunter's not here, because we had an extended back and forth about the value of affidavits and whether we wanted affidavits in another matter. But, you know, what's the committee supposed to do after the fact if they come in and say, well, because those were our non-federal activities and these people weren't doing any federal activities, we didn't think that we needed to keep those kind of time logs. But we do have an affidavit from the executive director.
Yes, it's in this pile of...
In the pile. I have a smaller pile.
Yes. I had to find this pile. This pile was not readily available. It took me a while to find the pile, which I found troubling.
The pile's not hard to find. I just looked for selected. I just took selected pieces of paper out of the pile.
That you were here when this was submitted. I was not. So I didn't have a file at the time. So I had to actually chase.
That's okay. But
it's down.
The papers are here in the building. We can find them.
If we don't know they exist, it's tough to know to ask for them. Anyway, sorry.
Anyway,
we agree there's an affidavit.
I'm trying to help you out here, Mr. Chairman. The affidavit says, to the best of my recollection and belief, no employee of the party spent more than 25% of his or her compensated time during any calendar month on activities in connection with a federal election until at least the late spring of 2004. And this is signed, and it's under oath. You know, that's, if not the perfect evidence, it certainly is evidence. And as I said last week, I'm willing to accept an affidavit, because I think we have to provide some avenue for somebody after the fact to do something, you know, to say, well, you know, how can I fix it now other than paying a large penalty? You know, is there any other way to establish this? I'm willing to accept this. Now, so my question, and I think that going back for a second to your question about the presumptions and the inferences. I think that we also have to recognize that one of the underlying assumptions of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act was that a certain amount of non-federal activity does benefit federal elections, and that's why they even reached into state activity in the first place. And that's why they said, if you spend even 25% of your time on federal activity, you have to be paid 100% with federal funds. You know, why would you not be paid 25% with federal funds if you spend only 25% of your time? But that's not the way Congress wrote the law. So I think that we have to acknowledge that Congress did expect that a certain amount of, there'd be a certain amount of bleed over in terms of the impact of some of these activities, and that it was appropriate to require federal funding, or not federal funding, but funding compliant with federal laws for activities that could have that benefit. So
if I could for a minute.
Sure.
I certainly agree. Congress has, through McCain-Feingold, certainly reached into the state parties to a degree that they hadn't reached in before. Much of what is now federal election activity used to be paid for in the overhead split. Our old friend 95-25, the AO from the RNC, that established kind of the overhead ratio for some of this stuff, which has been superseded by McCain-Feingold. But Congress didn't federalize everything.
No, they didn't.
There's definitely a line where they said, I remember I actually did a briefing soon after McCain-Feingold became the law, and I was criticized by the sponsors of it and made it in the newspaper. And Senator McCain himself had then generated a brief memo saying that, well, the federal election activity is just four narrow categories, and get out the vote, voter registration, communications that promote, attack, support, or oppose federal candidates, a term that we still haven't crisply defined, the so-called PASO. And then fourth, if you spend more than 25% of your time on federal elections. That's the line, though. And the reg that you read seems to say that if you don't spend more than 25% of your time, I don't see the reg as really cleanly saying you then have to keep a log. So I agree the affidavit certainly gets us where we need to go. And I think we can debate whether or not keeping the log or not keeping the log is a record-keeping violation or not, but I don't think the failure to keep the log then converts that employee's time presumptively into 100% federal when you have an affidavit to counteract it.
Trying to help you, Mr.
I know.
Chairman.
I'm agreeing. That's why I jumped. We're on the same page here, and I'm letting the good times roll. one thing though I do disagree with is you're trying to help me. I don't agree with that characterization, because this is a Missouri Democratic State Committee. I want to note for the record that the council is here. But under our procedures, he is not able to be recognized and address this on such legal issues as this. Maybe we can work on a little different system so we don't have our poor auditors sitting here. I agree, auditors should do audits. This is a legal question. And I do want to say that Mr. Stoltz's team, I've known them for years, they are tenacious, thorough, and do excellent work. So I don't want this to be a reflection on anyone here. I've known Mr. Bonowitz for years, and he is nothing if not tenacious and thorough. But this is a predicate legal question.
Good qualities in an auditor.
Yes, yes. And I agree we're going to send them out and do this kind of thing. And when auditors don't find documentation, they get suspicious, as they should. But whether or not that's a legal significance is a different question, but I think is a question here today. So I just wanted to jump in and sort of agree that Congress has drawn lines. But when they draw a line, it's not up to us to then go beyond that line, which is why I raised the jurisdictional question.
Well, I think that you and I agree, and we've said this in the past, that it actually would enhance our decision making if we had a procedure where we could invite Mr. Swoboda to come down to the front row from the back row and we could talk to him as well as our auditors, and I'd be happy to work with you on developing that kind of
thing. Certainly procedure. For legal questions. I wouldn't want to get into the details of how to do an audit. The numbers would not be something I think we need to hear from opposing counsel on, but legal questions such as this, I think it'd be very helpful, and I hope we can work together on that and achieve that goal. But
so I'm going to go back to my question for the auditors, which is if we take this affidavit as evidence, and it does raise this issue, and maybe you can help me out with this, of what does it mean to the results? the line in there that says in connection that they didn't do, they basically weren't doing federal activity until at least the late spring of 2004. If we were to assume that all the salary and I'm not sure how we mark the late spring of 2004, up until that time is appropriately classified as non-federal. I mean, it's A, you know, how would we mark off that time period? Because late spring of 2004 is a little bit vague. Do we have other documentation? Maybe I didn't take the right piece of paper out of the stack. And B, how would that affect the numbers? What would be left at that point, and what would it consist of?
Well, it would probably reduce, well, it would reduce the numbers almost in half. So, matter of fact, it would be like $1,178,773 reduced.
Reduced. That's a nice reduction. And then what's left? Let me back up for a second. And you can say that precisely, even though the affidavit's a little bit vague as to the time period?
Well, that's what we have. And they paid, at that point, they were still paying non-federal salary as well as federal salary. They were reporting salary being paid in the FEC reports at that time. But they were still making payments also for non-federal salary. So we don't have anything from the date that the executive director said. We don't have any documentation which demonstrates that indeed the rest of the payments being made to the non-federal employees was less than 25%. But there were still payments being made for salary even after the the date that is specified in the affidavit.
All right, but my question is, because the date in the affidavit is not a precise date, are you able to pinpoint a number? Because you seem to have a very precise number ready to go. Mr. Bonowitz, maybe you can help me out.
I just sort of flipped through the work papers real quick, the copies that I had, and it looks like most of the salary payments that we're questioning were in 2003 and early 2004. Now, we don't have a specific date, so I would have to speculate that we would probably lose all the salary, which is about $1.4 million. I believe all of it would fall within that affidavit, but that's the question. We don't have a specific date, and it doesn't appear that there are any salary payments late in 2004, just from a quick review of the work papers.
Because it sounded like you guys don't have the same number, because you said 1.1.
Well, my number reflects credit that we gave to them for timesheets that were submitted by the committee. So, and that totaled about like $192,000. So, which probably would bring it down to about what I said.
Yes, Leroy's correct. The figure I looked at is his gross figure, not where we netted out the salaries we gave him credit for.
Okay, so without polling, but you know, assuming for the moment, for the purposes of argument, that amount of money is off the table, what else is left here that we might have issues with or documentation issues?
That leaves approximately $885,173. And what we're calling 100% federal expenses, and $65,814 in admin expenses. So we're talking about, I guess, a little bit more than $900,000. If I might, that number probably would be further reduced because we did give them credit for money that could have been transferred over by the non-federal account for allocable expenses. That I think that totaled like $100,000 or so. So you can like deduct that amount from the $900,000 as well as transfers the federal committee made to the non-federal account. So it still would be a little reduction, maybe about close to maybe $200,000 off that gross number of $900,000 I gave you. So we're talking about maybe about $700,000 in total.
And so that there's admin, and then the larger category was?
Was 100% federal, yes.
100% federal. And our understanding that that is 100% federal is based on?
And that's based on no documentation at all for approximately $600,000 of that. And the rest is based on the documentation that we have. It appears that there is a federal component in that. And when I say that, I'm talking about like phone banks, media, things of that nature. Phone banks basically on like election day.
Banks on an election day where there were both federal and non-federal candidates on the ballot?
That's correct.
And the media, because I know the Missouri State Party said that they had submitted some
Right, and that eliminated, that was the a big reduction in what we had originally. The media we have left is basically, we have like an invoice that says for statewide television. Or we have consulting that says for statewide elections. So we really don't know exactly what that means, or we can't.
Remind me, in 2004, how many statewides were there in Missouri? There's a gubernatorial candidate. Was there a Senate candidate on the ballot now for?
Yes, Nancy Farmer.
Okay.
And they also supported two congressional candidates.
But those aren't state. Those aren't statewide.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Right.
Right. And the president.
Right, he'd be statewide.
And when you talk about consultants, does that include or exclude the services of Mr. Temple, who also submitted an affidavit?
Right, we excluded Mr. Temple at the interim audit report.
What's their explanation for the remaining? Commissioner Weintraub's writing down the numbers. I'm not about the 600 grand or the media. Let's call it the media money, right? Which is kind of the non-federal funds to pay for advertising. What's their explanation? They've submitted an affidavit. They've knocked the number down quite a bit. What's their explanation for what's left? Does the state party have any additional documentation or narrative explanation to explaining what that money was for?
Beyond what they submitted at the interim report, which consisted of the state election reports, and I guess their narrative, there is nothing else.
Okay. So you have the report, which says it's non-federal. You have the council brief says it's non-federal, and they have some charts here that were submitted. That seem to characterize, like for example, here I'm looking at a chart. It says a vendor was Dewey Hub, it's a phone bank, independent expenditure, McCaskill gubernatorial. See Missouri State Ethics Report number 11. They submitted a lot of charts and to try to break down this number.
That's correct.
Okay, so we do have that in addition to their contemporaneous filed report, and plus their own representations. All right, so there is a little bit more. It's not quite affidavit, but. They do characterize the remainder as non-federal, I think, as well. Is that? I mean, they still are suggesting, or more than suggesting, they're stating that even what's left is still should be 100% non-federal.
Well, that's what they're stating. Yes.
Okay. All right. Do we have any reason to disagree with what they've submitted, other than the inference that I have already explored?
Well. We don't have a reason to disagree. We just can't assure ourselves that that's what the payments were for.
Okay.
In the absence of external documentation. Even the charts are prepared by committee members, and we would look at that as an internally generated documentation.
Okay. Can we be comfortable as a commission then adopting as a finding that it should be 100% fed if we're just not sure?
Well, that is the position the commission has taken in a number of cases in the past, and you know sometimes if there is a follow-up action, you know, some of it gets sorted out there. Sometimes not. it's, you know, this, there has been a tension over this issue, I think, ever since we've had state and federal accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And what can we prove to our satisfaction and what can't we? And what do we presume about what we can't? I don't know that there is an ideal answer to it.
That's fair.
Can I ask a question of clarification? So did you accept the charts as some form of documentation or not?
No.
No. Okay. Because they were created after the fact or?
Internally generated.
Yes, we were looking for something. We didn't think the charts were that much more sufficient than the narrative. It was prepared by the committee. We were looking more for externally generated documentation, like an invoice, to support the expenditures.
Have any invoices?
No. You correct me if I'm wrong, but there's $600,000 or $700,000 in wires and checks where he didn't have anything. We don't even know who the payee was.
Even on wires?
That's correct.
How would they not know where a wire transfer went when the wire say where it would just be an account number?
Well, this was based on the bank statement itself would just say wire out.
Okay. Vice Chair.
When you audit somebody, do you take into consideration your experience with previous audits?
When we prepare for the audit, we do look at any prior audits that have taken place with respect to the committee to see the sort of issues that came up to help us prepare for the audit.
And then when you do that, do you talk to them about what they've done since the previous audit to improve upon problems you saw in the that previous audit in connection with the audit you're undertaking at this point?
Yes, we've had discussions with committee mm-hmm. officials about that during the course of the audit.
Mm-hmm. And did you do that in this case?
Yes, in fact, I think we met with them even after their response to the interim audit report to go over specifically what they provided and what we were looking for and to answer any questions.
When you had a previous audit of them, were there any discussions about what they would do to prevent this from happening in the future?
I wasn't on the previous audit, so I'm not exactly certain, but generally I would think at the exit conference when we discussed the matters with them, we would discuss with them changes to their system, whatever is necessary to improve in the future. I would suspect the auditors did that on previous audits.
Could I just clarify, there was a previous audit?
Right.
Which cycle?
This would be, let's see what this one is. There's a MER.
I know there was a MER. They paid $110,000 penalty, and there's a lot of corrective action in this. I remember reading the conciliation when it went.
This is the public. I think it was just the previous cycle before that. But I bring it up because we have a situation here where whether or not it's fair to draw an inference, and it's not always unfair to draw an inference based upon prior conduct. And in a case like this, it's showed here in the MIR that the respondent failed to provide documentation to demonstrate that $223,000 in expenses paid from non-federal accounts related solely to non-federal activities. An absence of showing a proration was agreed upon based upon the ballot composition, which was interesting then. But in any event, certainly the problem existed then. And for me, it's not unfair to draw an inference when you see prior conduct of the same kind, not too long before that, not keeping records, knowing that this is a part of the responsibility, part of the law, and not getting done. So, I mean, if you didn't take that into consideration, then whatever inference you draw would be absent that information. But wanted to get that clarified.
There were four previous audits of this committee, and in two of those audits, the issue of federal, non-federal expenditures was raised. So we were aware of it, but we did not use that as a basis in determining expenditures from the current audit to be questioned or not. But it did give us guidance that we needed to look in that area because of previous audits and concerns in those areas.
Well, then from my perspective, when we look at civil penalties and that kind of thing, To me, it's important to see whether or not this is the first time around, and yes, we're some make, yes, we were sloppy. We should have done a better job. We realize now, and I think we all feel like that's fair when you consider the size of our reg book. But when people have been through it and through it and through it and been through our audit, and they still know that, and then it happens, then I don't feel quite so quite the same way. So I'm just wondering what it takes to get this right now.
For what it's worth, my opinion, that they did a better job this time than the last time around.
They are getting better. Let me, I know Commissioner Weintraub wants to speak, but just to, before I just, if I could, 2 points. First, I think although they've been audited before, and I agree with the vice chair, that does, I think, in some instances could allow us to not necessarily require as much proof and allow us to infer certain things. But in this case, we've had the law change significantly between the prior activity and this activity. And the reality is state parties are always confronting these issues. So when we have a federal election activity issue, such as the wages and that kind of thing, or even TV ads, I'm not so sure in this case we can then say, well, because they had issues with something to do with Fed versus non-Fed before, that's the same issue they have here. The fact the law changed and it's gotten more confusing, not less confusing, it allows me to draw an inference that they're just confused. But that doesn't necessarily mean it was illegal.
I would just add to that, though, I'm not saying they're confused about the law, but there wasn't any change in the fact that records should be kept. And I think, to my knowledge, at least, that to me is something that we should try and make clear that people need to keep good records.
I agree. If we're going to try to reach out and require people to keep records of even things that they think are 100% non-Fed, then let's try to do that. At least folks could then challenge that rule and say that's beyond their jurisdiction. But now we're in a situation here where we have this particular Democratic Party committee who says they did 100% non-Fed, and now we're saying, well, you didn't keep enough records, or you didn't keep records the way we want you to keep records, or we didn't keep enough records. And this is something that's come up in other audits. As Mr. Stoltz indicated, this is a tension that's happened before. And it's going to keep happening more and more now, I would suggest, even more than before, because of this concept of federal election activity and the fact that the federal law now reaches into state parties much more than it used to. But we can't then, in this context, make a finding, I think, that says, well, they broke the law without some sort of rule ahead of time that is a little bit more clear than this. Commissioner Weintraub, I know you want to be recognized. I apologize for not doing that, but I wanted to agree agree in principle, yet not in this case, with the vice chair.
I just wanted to point out the vice chairman said something about what we should or could take into account in setting civil penalties, and I wanted us all to be clear that we're not setting any civil penalties here today. This is an audit; it's not an enforcement matter, and so we're just looking at what findings we're going to make here. Which is it's a very different context.
Can I ask you a question about that? What's the distinction between making a finding that says that they broke the law, and I understand the penalty phase is different, but why is there a distinction between this simply because it's called an audit? It's still a legal. We're essentially setting the rule of law here, depending on what we do here today. So why is that not something that?
No, I'm just, my sole point, I'm not making a big point, just right. A little point, that we're not setting any civil penalties here today.
Right, I agree with that,
not,
okay.
That's
a different day.
That's all.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Sorry. Mr. Peterson's been patiently waiting.
Let me first of all just wanted to agree with something that Commissioner Weintraub mentioned earlier about that we want our auditors to go out and seek and obtain documentation, and we want committees to actually keep good records and provide that documentation when an audit takes place. And as she also mentioned, this was a discussion that we started last week in a different matter. And you know, the issue that keeps coming up in my mind is, in an audit, what's when we don't have sufficient documentation, just going back to the big theme of this discussion, what can we infer from that? And especially in the context of an audit, I mean, how should we couch our findings in the, when we don't have documentation? Is there any problem? Would there be a problem? This is, I guess, a larger policy discussion. In my mind, when we have an audit should be able to come back and conclusively say, well, you know, when we have documentation, when we have hard data, when we have backing documents, we should be able to, you know, when the auditors have information that's based on hard data and they can draw conclusions, then obviously those should be included in the findings. But when we don't have that documentation, it's this whole issue of inference. I guess the question I would ask, and maybe I could ask Mr. Stoltz, and maybe this is a discussion for the commission, and maybe this is something we can't really, and obviously something we can't necessarily resolve here, is why could we not, in that circumstance, say we just don't know? We can say there were these expenditures that were made, and there was not adequate documentation provided. As a result, we cannot draw a conclusion as to whether or not these were purely non-federal, whether these were should have been paid for 100% federal, whether they should have been allocable. We just don't know. There is insufficient documentation to draw any conclusions. So the question I have is, in the way we couch our findings, should we be considering whether we need to modify the way we couch those findings when we don't have the documentation to say for certain what it is we know and what it is we don't know? Maybe I could ask that question, Mr. Stoltz.
Well, in a lot of ways, that's what the finding says. And the question is, what's the next step? Do we read anything into that, or do we just say the records weren't sufficient to draw conclusions? And I agree with you. We'd love to be able to go out and go through the records. It's all there. And come back and say, well, we know the answer. It would be great. Doesn't seem to happen all that often, but it would be a nice way to do business. So then the only question is, what, going back to what the chairman's been talking about, do we draw any inference from that? If we don't draw an inference from it, then what's the next step? Is there a next step? The records were inadequate for us to draw a conclusion. In the public accounting world, or like the folks that come and audit us, run into that situation, they have the option of turning around and walking away and saying, we disclaim an opinion. And that is very bad news for an audited organization in that world. I'm not sure in this context it would accomplish much.
You mentioned that in a way we do acknowledge that there was lack of documentation, but we do kind of take it one step further. In the finding, we say, as a result, the amount the Missouri Democratic State Committee is required to transfer to its non-federal operating account for its share of federal expenses, you know, is, I'm looking at the original number of about $2.5 million. So we still do draw an inference, and we say you can correct this by transferring money from your federal to your non-federal. So in essence, that the only way you're going to remove that inference is if we're going to presume that you did not adequately, that you did break the law in the way that you were paying for these activities, and now you need to, we're going to assume that was the case all along, and now you need to transfer that money over. And so I guess a larger question we're going to have to grapple with is that an appropriate thing to do in a finding of an audit, or do we just need to keep it limited to just for these expenditures we just don't know? And so I think that this will probably have to be a discussion that obviously will continue long after this one. I just have a question for the auditors about something that was brought up in the, I think this was in the January 31st, 2008 letter that was provided by the Missouri Democratic Committee's counsel. They claimed that the auditors departed from a past practice and made findings based on originally filed reports rather than from the amendments on file when the audit notice was sent. And I just wanted to ask, is that an accurate statement? Was there a change in, from past practice? And if so, what was the reason for changing that practice?
I'll go ahead and answer that. I believe that in that case, they're referring to another finding that was in the interim report, but based on materials they submitted, the finding was removed because it was determined that no error existed. It was a misstatement finding based on originally filed reports.
The characterization, though, is a change. Understand that the issue is now moot, but the issue of whether or not the policy has changed isn't moot.
Well, I don't remember which cycle it was, but last cycle, we added to our procedures, in addition to doing a bank reconciliation, comparing bank figures to the most recently filed reports, we took those bank figures and compared them to reports as originally filed to see if there was any significant misstatement as originally filed.
I share the view, I think, of Commissioner Peterson and Commissioner Weintraub that this is, in this context, we are looking for documentation, and I think, as Mr. Stoltz correctly points out, there are several people in this room who are very familiar with the idea of digging up documentation to substantiate an audit, as we just went through, as the chairman announced earlier. We were successful in that endeavor, so that was, but that took a lot of hard work on the part of folks, and that is what an audit is about, of course, is to provide that, to determine whether there is the external documentation to support the reports. And I guess my view is that this is the recommendation of the audit division. I think the question is what are the next steps. So I don't read these as legal determinations as to the compliance or non-compliance with an actual finding. As Commissioner Weintraub points out, there are no penalties associated with an audit report. In this particular case, I do think that it makes sense if you, as a reading of 106.7, to look for records of employee allocation of employee work. It seems to me you have to know whether someone gets over that threshold. You have to know whether their work is 25% federal, non-federal, or 30% non-federal, not federal versus non-federal, in order to figure out which rule to apply. And it seems to me that someone who's as busy as an executive director or someone who is running a large statewide program is probably not keeping track in their head of all of their employees and their different responsibilities. So it seems to make sense to me that would be an important way to be able to comply with this regulation. We do have an affidavit, and I do think that with that evidence, it would make sense to me that we adjust that part of the finding with respect to salaries, because we do have someone who's willing to assert under oath that there were less than that until late spring, and this is a while ago, so I can understand why we're sort of fuzzy about the time frame. Sounds like we do have some understanding of when that might be. But I think in this, just because I think in this case that might make some sense for us to accept, as a general premise, I don't think that means that you never have to keep a log. Is if you believe that those activities, if your plan for this campaign is to spend 25% or to have 25% salaries, I still think it'd be a far better idea to keep those logs. Obviously, this rule is gone by the wayside, but I think that would have been the best way to go about complying with this law, because the 25% threshold versus 30% is a key trigger into how which money you have to spend on these salaries. And so I think that is not unreasonable, and is certainly an important way that someone could be complying with this version of the regulation. So although in this case I do think that I'd be willing to accept this affidavit, I think it's an unusual case, and in general I would have expected that someone would have those records.
Thank you. If I could actually add a few things to that. The notion that well, there's no penalty here. I agree there's no monetary penalty. And this is something that I think the commission has grappled with long before we were here, and probably, unfortunately, will continue to grapple with long after we're gone. But maybe not. Maybe we can help it a little bit. There's still a penalty here because it is a finding. And although this gets into the question that has come up, is this just a finding of our auditors, or is this the commission
adopting the finding of the auditors, and therefore it's the commission finding. Well, it's on the Federal Election Commission letterhead. It has our seal at the top. We have to vote on it. And in my view, this is something that the commission owns. This is not just a, well, this is just what the auditor said kind of thing. Because the way the audit report's captioned is, you know, first page, findings and recommendations, find payment of federal activity with non-federal funds. Finding two, you know, on the summary page, payment of federal activity with non-federal funds. And although there's some text that says maybe it's wishy-washy, it doesn't necessarily say we're unable to render a finding. It still says that they appeared to have improperly made payments totaling $5 million and change from its non-federal operating account. So I don't really agree with the notion that there's no penalty here. When you read news reports of our audits, folks certainly think that these are findings and that there's violations of law. Even since we've been here, we've adopted some audit reports where the headlines have been, you know, such and such a committee broke the law, and some version of that. So I think that's a penalty in and of itself. It's certainly a finding that in the world in which we govern, which is the political world, just having a adverse finding is really something that is not good. And whether one wants to characterize it as a penalty as a matter of law or not, I leave others to. I don't think that's really is all that critical. It certainly does harm. What state parties ought to do and not do, and I think you're probably right, the probably prudent course is to keep some timesheets, but the question is whether or not they have to keep timesheets. In the 2004 cycle, you either paid your employees with all hard or all soft. Now you actually would pay them on the split if they were under the 20, if they're 25% or less, right? So under that theory, I would think perhaps, and we're not deciding this issue today, but perhaps going forward, maybe state parties then would have to keep timesheets for everyone, because then, if it's on the split, that reg would reach out and then require records to be kept to prove up the split. But in the 04 cycle, that was not the case. If it was 100% non-fed, they wouldn't have to keep the log unless it was something that was 100% fed. You see what I'm saying? You're sort of giving me the maybe.
I just read the regulations a little bit differently.
I understand. But I think we may agree that post-Shays, whatever it was, and with the change in the rule, this is not a situation that'll come up again, I don't think, in at least with a state party, because you're not going to have employees being paid 100% non-fed. They would be paid on the overhead split.
Well, but what if they say, I'm not sure that's true, because okay. If they say that the non-federal employees, that the certain staff people were doing exclusively non-federal work. So it wasn't, they're not paying them on the split. They're paying them zero federal because mm-hmm. they did zero federal work. And then we're going to have the same question of what kind of documentation would they need, if any, to justify that.
That's a good point. I think you're right. Which then brings back to should they keep timesheets across the board or not. I think as a practical matter, what state parties are doing is they are saying, we have our folks who do stuff that we're going to pay for with all hard because they're doing federal elections, and we're not even going to worry about the 25% rule. It's a practical matter. The 25% rule, I think, is going by the by. This is an example where if Mr. Sobota was addressing us, we could probably ask him the question now, you know, what's really happening out there. But I'm just going to have to bring my own experience to the table on this. But my sense is that you have your federal 100% hard employees, and then you have your non-fed employees that only do gubernatorial races or redistricting or state legislative elections and don't get anywhere near anything that could be get out the vote or voter registration. They really just deal with state candidates to the degree they can under state law, which means my guess is state parties wouldn't be keeping timesheets for those people because they're just sort of doing the cut at the beginning, which is why it's not surprising that they would think an affidavit from the executive director would say, well, you know, I just kind of divide the world between fed and non-fed, and this is, so that's why I think that level of proof is good. But to say that they should keep timesheets, I think about the county party that hasn't really become a political committee in our eyes and hasn't filed with us. I think the Libertarian Party probably didn't realize they signed up for this today in was it Colorado? That now they may have to keep timesheets of all their employees. Let's say you're a county party that hasn't filed, and so you're doing essentially local candidate, state candidate work, but for some reason, you know, you made a contribution to a federal candidate over one of the thresholds, or you do something that triggers whether it's a $1,000 threshold or $5,000 threshold. There's a couple different hoops you jump through, and it turns out that we find out about that and say, gee, you should have reported. And then the next question is, well,
how did you pay for your employees? And now, they're not going to be keeping timesheets because they just don't think. So I'm not sure that we can necessarily say going forward that everyone has to keep timesheets in all cases. I agree it's probably the prudent course, but I'm not sure that in all cases, the affidavit still wouldn't bail out some parties. I see the council's office is going to clarify and help me in my thinking on this.
Mr. Chairman, for what it's worth, the actual text of the regulation at 106.7D1 is committees must keep a monthly log of the percentage of time each employee spends in connection with a federal election.
Right.
I think a monthly log that said zero would be sufficient to comply with that, but it does say that committees must keep a monthly log of each employee.
I agree. My hypothetical, though, is the county party who doesn't think that they're a committee. And then, somebody makes a contribution, the chairman runs out with a checkbook and makes a contribution, crosses the line, and then all of a sudden, you look in the rearview mirror for that cycle, and they don't have anything because they didn't think they were a committee. They weren't at the time. They became a committee. What happens if they become a committee halfway through the cycle? When does the obligation to start keeping timesheets? These are the kind of things that confront, and I just want to keep open the option for the proverbial little guy, the local parties, or even the unsophisticated state parties, having represented state parties, it's amazing how bare-boned some of them are. They may have two or three people working. They're not the massive operations that the national committees have here in D.C. And Commissioner Weintraub probably saw this in her days in private practice as well. They're not necessarily the infrastructure-heavy operations. But I just want to make sure going forward that it's clear that in case it comes up again. But I do agree with Commissioner Bowerly that it does make sense that they ought to be keeping timesheets at their committee because, the reg says so. What are we going to do with this? I agree with Commissioner Peterson's sense that it's tough to adopt a finding. Is there a middle ground short of saying, we accept the finding and not calling it a finding? Is there a way to characterize things as, we drilled this well, we just don't have documentation to conclusively say one way or another? It doesn't do violence to the fact the auditors look for things. It maintains essentially the work product. But when it gets to the legal conclusion, is there a way to sort of characterize it differently? Commissioner Weintraub.
Again, I think I think there probably is language that we might be able to agree on. I'm not sure that I'm comfortable with, we don't know, something more along the lines of documentation did not establish. I would probably feel a little bit more comfortable with, because it's a little bit more neutral. As always, Mr. Chairman, you think of all sorts of interesting hypotheticals, but we're not dealing with the little, county committee that accidentally tripped over the line. We're dealing with a state party committee, and while I agree with you that some state party committees are better organized than others, they knew that they were doing some federal activity, and I was very pleased to read in council submission about all the steps that they have taken in the interim to try and make sure that their operation is run more professionally and in a more compliant fashion. So hopefully we won't be running into these kinds of problems again with this committee. I think we still come back to the question of what do we do. We can, the salary issue we can finesse because we've got an affidavit, but what do we do with the $600,000 or $700,000 for which there just doesn't seem to be much documentation, other than there's like the charts and things, which I think we probably have varying degrees of how probative we consider them. And what I come back to is a sense of what kind of incentives are we creating if we reach a point where we say, if there are no records, then we draw every presumption in favor of the party committee and assume that it was as they say it was. That creates an incentive for people to keep no records. So I'm concerned about walking down that road.
Sort of, but let's not forget there's also state law here, and my guess is the state law probably would have required some records. They may have issues on the state side, right? If the state of Missouri decided to audit their spending, I have never had to deal with that in Missouri, so I'm not sure. I've dealt with the California folks. They have random audits and that sort of stuff. But Sorry, I just lost my train of thought. Somebody put something in front of me unrelated. I apologize.
You know what?
The state law, I think, would maybe require records, maybe not. But is that something, again, within our purview? And I agree, though, we can't send a message if you just don't have any documents, then we let you go. I don't think we need to create a presumption or an inference that if you don't have documents, it's a get-out-of-jail-free card. But on the other hand, when we rely, as I understand, solely on an inference that the absence of documentation means, therefore, you broke federal law, I think that goes too far as well. So there's got to be some kind of middle ground here. We have affidavits. I find the publicly available reports to be certainly probative. I think we could probably agree that they're probative. Now, to the degree how much that carries the day or not, I think finders of fact can disagree on that. I find them very helpful and persuasive, not necessarily conclusive, but probably a little more persuasive than I sense you do, but maybe not. And the charts and that kind of thing shows that they do have some basis. And it seems that a lot of times you do go on memory. People remember, well, yeah, we did all these ads, and I can't find the comp reel, but they were all gubernatorial related. And it could be they don't have records because maybe they were done, you know, who knows, in concert or coordination with the state candidate. Maybe it was the state candidate's consultant. Maybe it's just a different system than we have. Some of this was characterized as independent expenditures, so maybe that doesn't work. But I agree that the sort of, we're to the stage of discussion. Now, what sort of message do we send going forward? I'm not sure we can decide that today. The vice chair has actually asked we take a 5-minute recess to discuss a couple of these things and take care of some other business. So if that's okay, we can maybe recess for 5 minutes and then reconvene just a little past 11:30. Thank you. Okay, we're back in recess. Over.
I didn't even get to play dodgeball.
Could you imagine the commission plays dodgeball?
Do it right in here.
Right in here. Who would Mac dress up as the guy who was the pirate? My sense is there's a consensus that the inference idea is not as strong, but in this case this is my sense is also that the affidavit is kind of persuaded, and my sense is that we probably need to send this back and have the audit, have the report revised consistent with discussion at the table. One thing I didn't mention earlier, and I kind of thought of it on the recess, is that coming out of the gate, I think the position of the auditors was that even the convention expenses were going to be presumed federal unless they showed otherwise. I thought, as a matter of law, convention expenses are 100% non-fed.
As far as FEA is concerned, we were looking at them as possibly an admin expense.
Oh, so I guess a convention expense could be federal election activity if it was not really a convention, but a backdoor get-out-the-vote, voter registration, promote, support, support, oppose a federal candidate kind of thing. Is that the theory?
Well, we were looking at it, I guess, again, as an admin expense, an allocable expense, based on, I guess, really just what their bylaws states the purpose of the convention.
Mr. Chairman, there was also a little confusion in this area because there was one compliance action where the lower state convention expenses were part of the mix, and in that case they wound up admin expenses. You know, we were looking at that, and then we went back and looked more at the explanation justification for the reg, and consulted with counsel and thought better of it and conceded on the convention expenses.
Okay, so I'm not crazy. As a matter of law, convention expenses are supposed to be 100% non-fed. The E&J to that rule actually,
yes,
that rather clearly states that, right? Okay, all right. So we have any discussion thoughts on what to do now? My thought is we, I think we agree on finding one, but I think finding two, it doesn't seem to be sufficient support to adopt it as is. And I think given the discussion,
it may be best to let the auditors revise the report in a way consistent with the discussion we've had here today, at least as to the numbers, and then maybe decide how far we go. There's the remaining 600 grand. I'm inclined to say that their reports and their narrative is probably sufficient for me to preclude a finding that it should have been federal. But that may not be where everyone else is. But for the remainder of the money, my sense is that the audit should be revised. I don't want to speak for others. Is that consistent with good enough?
For my own purposes, as I said earlier, I think the affidavit is sufficient, although not ideal, is sufficient to deal with the salary issue. I think you're right. We're not exactly in the same place on the balance of the $600,000 or $700,000 that's left. But
it's tough to know where we are without parsing these numbers down now, yeah, based upon our discussion.
With our sending it back to the auditors, and I suspect that what might yet support eventually would be language more along the lines that I suggested earlier, that the documentation doesn't support or establish one way or the other.
Other thoughts on that approach?
I'm comfortable with that approach. I think that would be the right one to take.
Mr. Malley's nodding.
That'll be fine with me.
No, just for,
okay.
Mr. Chairman, just one thing for the record. I just want to make clear. I'm not. I think our agreement extends to the salary issue, but not to the rest of the. You're in my agreement. I agree with you with respect to the salary issue. I'm not quite there with you with respect to the other.
Okay, so you don't think we should send it back on those other issues as well?
No, I agree. We should send it back and I think that's the right result. But I just for the record, I think that there's limited agreement. There's perhaps more consensus on one item than there is on the other.
Okay, fair enough. Procedurally, to the general counsel, now that we're at this point where we feel we need to revise procedurally, what's the next step here?
As you've done, you can direct the audit division to revise the audit report, and it can be circulated again on tally. It's subjected to, again, we'll have a discussion like we've had today.
Do we need a vote to so instruct the auditors, or is what we've done sufficient?
I think what we've done is sufficient.
You
if the auditors more. Understand the direction, you might want to ask them that.
I think we got the direction.
Okay, got it. We can go through it again, but it would be painful. And that is another announcement. We're going to try to have a hearing in January. The date is in flux regarding some of our procedures. We're going to seek comment, and I was trying to move it through a little fast, and with the guidance of particularly Commissioner Weintraub, but the Vice Chair and Commissioner Bowerly, I think we're going to try to work out a schedule where we're going to try to have some comment on some of our procedures, and maybe the audit procedure is one we could talk about. So for those in the out there who may want to file comments, be on the lookout for a notice saying such thing. But I don't want to get in too much detail because we actually haven't done the notice yet, so I don't want to jump the gun. With that, are there last item, management administrative matters? Are there any additional items under that category that we need to discuss?
There are none.
Anything else for the good of the order? Hearing nothing else for the good of the order, meeting is hereby adjourned. Thank you.